We're back. We left you last time discussing the origins and early decades of African slavery and some of these forces that work together, both of racism and economics, to bring this slavery into a more mature form and having a much greater effect on these British North American colonies. Now, even though we have to discuss these things in a certain order, but what I want you to do is to appreciate the complexity here and the way this is in effect kind of a feedback loop, and that some of these factors we're going to list now, which are the consequences of bringing slaves into the colonies, were also some of the factors and forces that led to them being introduced in the first place. And first here, for these consequences of bringing slaves into the colonies, are the slave codes themselves. Now, we talked about how these slave codes helped to both codify and clarify the relationship between white and black in the colonies, and over time legally enforce and put into place slavery. Well, we've already talked about that. And in their mature form, these slave codes do stop at some point evolving, and they reflect a particular set of cultural norms. And in their mature form, they ensured that the blacks are enslaved and that how whites ought to handle their slaves. And in particular, there are three distinctive features of them. They outlaw any slave from learning to read or write. Now, remember, we know that there's a different reality often from the law that's in the books and the actual practice and how people govern themselves. So obviously what we're talking about here are the structures and laws that are on the statutes, but nevertheless, they're instructive. And again, number one, outlawing any slave from learning to read or write. Number two, to prevent the slaves from hunting or using firearms. And then number three, made it illegal for three or more slaves to meet without an attendant. So the slave codes in their mature form are one of these consequences of having enough Africans enslaved in the colonies that the British colonists want a legal system that separates white and black. And of course, that's the only way that you're going to ensure that one group of people are masters and that the other are enslaved. You have to keep them separate. Number two, another consequence is the promotion of racism. And again, we're seeing this on both sides of this equation, and racism is one of the forces that plays a part in the beginning of African slavery, but it's also reinforced and enhances slavery over time. And whites promote the racism to justify slavery. And this is a vicious cycle that works with slavery in turn, justifies racism. It's a cycle that feeds back on itself, a loop that feeds back on itself. Number three, the wealthy whites use the racism to prevent the poor uniting against them. One of the things that the wealthy slave owners fear is that the poor whites and the enslaved will realize that in many cases, in many ways, they have a common cause against the wealthy slave owners. But racism is used by the wealthy whites to indicate to the poor whites that under any circumstance, their lot is better, and that in fact, in slavery helps to ensure that the poor whites are not at the lowest rung of the social ladder. And a particular mechanism here were slave patrols. Often poor and wealthy did not interact socially, but the slave patrols, which were organized by county and district, were places in which poor and wealthy whites met, and in the course of meeting, there would be an interaction that reinforced a degree of superiority that the poor whites should feel over those who were enslaved. In other words, all whites, regardless of how poor, were better than the blacks. Number three, miscegenation laws. And these laws, which in many cases were on the books in states well into the 1960s, ensured the sexual separation of the races. They prevented any sexual union between the races. And so this, of course, is necessary, that if you're going to keep white and black separate, we've got to prevent a sexual mingling of the races. Now, we know from abundant records that, in fact, on slave plantations, there's a lot, a disturbing amount of sexual interaction, predation that takes place by masters against female slaves. And of course, you can imagine the torture that the wives and daughters felt seeing children born out of the slave quarters who were light-skinned and might well resemble their fathers. But nevertheless, these laws were on the books to try to keep the races apart. Now, here in particular, let's talk about South Carolina. And we gave you some early information about the founding of South Carolina in 1670 as a grant to 8 favorites of the king. And these men, in turn, essentially farmed out the possibility of colonization to some of their friends and favorites from the Caribbean islands, particularly Barbados. And the reason this is instructive is because whereas we will see some degree of tension between rights, ideology, and philosophies born of Europe and the English that will put some constraints and moderations on slavery, there's some tension there inherent in the condition of the slave. In South Carolina, that is not the case. The South Carolina Constitution, from its inception as a colony, gives the master, as the Constitution said, complete control over his slaves, irregardless of religion or other fetters. This was a colony born from those who had helped to found and bring Barbados to be one of the most prosperous sugar plantation colonies in the world. They had a vast majority of the population of Barbados was enslaved, and then their white descendants, and in fact some Barbados planters, will help to found South Carolina. So in fact, whereas others embrace slavery more slowly, other societies and colonies do, South Carolina, that's not the case. They embrace it with a kind of vigor that's not seen in the other colonies. Originally, South Carolina is only moderately prosperous, and it produces a fair amount of naval stores. And we've talked about these earlier, and these are the kind of products that are necessary to keep ships and navies afloat. Pine tar, rosin, trees, hemp for rope, and this sort of thing. And these provide a consistent income, but you're not going to have a prosperous colony from it. And rice proves to be the most prosperous early cash crop, and in time, rice will give way to cotton, and both of these require an abundant amount of labor to work them. South Carolinians import slaves early and often for the growing of rice, and in fact, the colony offered 50 acres for each slave brought into the colony. So they were actually paying money, in effect, to bring the enslaved into South Carolina. South Carolinians in particular paid a very high fee for slaves from the Windward Islands, which are off the coast of Africa. Why? Because, as it turns out, a majority of these slaves from the Windward Islands had an immunity to malaria. And in fact, that's born out of a genetic mutation that today is sickle cell anemia. Turns out if you have sickle cell anemia, you have an immunity to malaria. So South Carolinians didn't understand why it was the case, but slaves from these Windward Islands virtually never got malaria. So rice here in South Carolina proves to be a consistent cash crop. It paid very well. And then over time, they will eventually switch to cotton. and the percentage of the population in South Carolina was 70% black, 70% enslaved. And at certain times of the year in the plantation area of South Carolina, in the what they call the Low Country, which is closer to the coast, the percentage might approach 95% because many of the white owners fled the Low Country with its mosquitoes, and as they sought miasmas that would come out of the swamps and bear vapors that would carry the diseases, they fled. And so this colony in particular will grow up prosperous, predominantly with the enslaved, and with an increasing degree of a culture that's insular and fearful of rebellions and being overthrown. The whites in South Carolina will deal with being a minority by imposing the harshest control on their slaves of any of the colonies. They are fearful of revolts and they live in terror. Now, having said all this, we have not discussed the fact that blacks resisted. And for too long, the histories of slavery simply told the story of people who endured slavery and seemed in the books, in the histories that were told, to do very little to resist. And of course, this colored our perspective about the relationship between white and black. But more nuanced studies now, we understand the ways human psychology manifests itself in these situations in which a revolt will not get you home, and in which you are often without the weapons to even try to defend yourself if you did want to revolt. But blacks did resist, and they resisted the harsh treatment in a number of ways. Number one, they developed a new language. It's called Gullah, Gullah, G-U-L-L-A-H. And this language exists and survives even today. The number of its practitioners has dwindled to less than 200, and they're on a few islands off the coast of South Carolina, and linguists are in a race to try to do what they can to document this language before the last people speaking it die away. And so, why Gullah? Well, obviously, if the slaves are able to speak their own language, which was a mix of English and a number of other languages, then they can actually sit in the backboard, in the back of a buggy or a wagon, and speak openly about the master who might be sitting there right next to them. And so, to a degree, this is a kind of resistance. Secondly, whites were mystified at the number of broken tools. It seemed that the enslaved were utterly incompetent in using what I grew up being told were the tools of ignorance. And those are the things I grew up being put to work with, shovels and pickaxes. And they're virtually impossible to break in any kind of normal usage. But in fact, slaves broke them often. Why? Because they simply don't want to do the work. Number three, they play dumb. Coming from modestly successful and prosperous societies in Africa, suddenly they were absolutely incapable of undertaking and following any kind of instruction. They played dumb as a way to offer resistance. But, and still at other times, four here, they revolted. And we'll tell you about some of those revolts. And they are bloody and vicious revolts of desperate people trying to gain some degree of freedom, even though where they would go and how they would ever get away is hard to imagine. But nevertheless, they did revolt at times in bloody uprisings. For now, put a line in your notes. We've given you a flavor of this slavery that gets introduced, and we will come back to it later on. For now, let's switch gears and tell you, give you a little snapshot of the economies. And here, I want you to be thinking 1650, 1675, something like that, maybe even shading towards 1700. And what I want you to get a sense of is what these economies are after the colonies become stable, and they are becoming, they have the makings of becoming genuinely prosperous colonies. In the Northeast, and here we're talking New England, the New English, who originally are rooted in subsistence agriculture, by the 1650s, there is a growing amount of prosperity here that results from fishing, the mining of iron ore, shipbuilding, and a triangular trade that involves fish, food, and rum. Fish, food, rum, and also sugar. And this triangular trade would involve ships owned by New Englanders. Say, take a ship from Boston. And it would take fish caught off the Outer Banks somewhere in the North Atlantic, off the coast of Canada, present-day Canada, and would sail down with its cargo of fish down to, let's say, Barbados, or one of the sugar plantations owned by the French or the British, there to sell the fish, because this fish, particularly some of the cheaper kinds, would be used to feed the slaves. These sugar plantation islands had very little land allocated for food. They counted on bringing that in. It was cheaper for them to do that than to lose acreage for sugar planting to make food. They would then pick up sugar or other commodities and sail those to England, where in England other goods would be picked up and sailed across the northern Atlantic back into New England. And this triangular trade, the shipbuilding and the mining of iron ore and fishing, increasingly, although not spectacular returns compared to the possibilities with rice or tobacco, were over a decent period of time a steady, ongoing, prosperous return. Secondly, the middle colonies. And here, obviously, we're talking primarily about Pennsylvania. And these middle colonies are the breadbasket of the colonies. They produce grains, fruits, but there's also some purchasing of furs from the Indians. More might have even been developed here, particularly in New York, if not for a stifling kind of land development, a stifling method of land ownership that was instituted by the Dutch. The Dutch granted a number of families very large land holdings in New York, outside of New York City and up the Hudson, and it stifled development in New York. But even despite that, Pennsylvania and New York become the breadbasket of these colonies and producing lots of grains and fruit. Now, further south in the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia, Maryland, tobacco and some grains remained the staple here, and third, some livestock. And despite the fluctuations in price of tobacco, and it'll have some relatively wild swings in price, the Chesapeake Bay colonies are extremely prosperous. Deeper into the south, particularly South Carolina, we see tobacco, naval stores, rice, and then small amounts at this point of what we call Sea Island cotton. There are two kinds of cotton, a Sea Island cotton and then an upland cotton. And the Sea Island cotton has to grow in a salt, watery marsh. And so it grows in the tidal regions along rivers along the Atlantic, where the salt water is brought in as the tide rises to wash these fields and areas along the river. And that's the only area it can grow. Charleston here is the most prosperous, one of the most prosperous cities, and certainly of the Deep South. And way down at the bottom of here on these colonies that are stretched out along the eastern seaboard is Georgia. It's originally founded as a buffer zone against the Spanish, and some of the very first settlers here are actually jailbirds. They're goons who have been unleashed from English jails to live a life as settlers in Georgia. I've got a friend from Georgia, and I try not to remind him of that if we're in good terms. If not, I tell him the true origin of where Georgians come from. Here, let's switch gears yet again and talk a little bit about class structure. And I want you to see a little bit of the a flavor for both the larger trends here at work, but then some of the regional variation. In the South, there is the most conscious effort to try to replicate social classes that are found in the New World, that are found in the Old World. So, in effect, those in the South attempt to bring the Old World social class structure over to the New World. Here, focus on Maryland and what happens to Maryland. My argument to you is land plays a big part in changing all of that, but it's certainly not the only factor. In the South, there arises a group who call themselves the natural elite. And they are, they believe, by birth and breeding of a higher order. So if you get a chance and you go to Colonial Williamsburg, which after Jamestown was the capital of Virginia for about 200 years, and you can go there, and it's largely been reconstructed as if it were during its in its colonial era. And you can go there, and they have an actor who plays Thomas Jefferson. And like Jefferson, this actor is tall and lanky with a shock of light red hair. And if you cross paths with this actor, he actually will treat you the way Jefferson would. And that is with only a quick glance that is largely dismissive of you. And he would have to be pressed to engage you because he is, like Washington and others of this Southern elite, a natural elite. They are born and bred through rearing and wealth and training. They are a natural group of leaders. Now, the irony is, for all of this haughtiness, they do perform public works out of societal obligation. They become sheriffs, burgesses, judges. And for them, there is an obligation they feel to serve in government and to do good works, to do the public's will. Now, what grows here in part out of this emergence of a natural elite is a different notion of equality than you will have in other places in the country, because often these men are slaveholders. And so for them, a degree of equality that they have is maintained among the whites in part by the enslavement of blacks that free whites from many types of menial tasks, and so that they can spend time on philosophy and what their view is higher order types of challenges to maintain liberty in their societies. Yet even while there is this natural elite, you have an emerging class in Virginia, which is large, might encompass in all total 50% of the population, who are modestly prosperous, stable farmers here, who have their own land, and by virtue of their own land, they have a degree of independence that they would not have had while being landless in England. To the north of the Chesapeake Bay here in New England, in the middle colonies, the wealthy are the merchants. They're a social elite, but their elite is open to those with money or those who make money. There tends to be a more fluid situation here in New England in the middle colonies than there is in the South. And in the far deep South, the upper class congregate in Charleston, and they come closest to replicating high society in England. Now, they're not wealthy by English standards, but they make every pretense to be, and relative to the colonies as a whole, they are fabulously wealthy. Now, we've talked here largely about division, but what I think is most fascinating here is the emergence of, and most significant, a middle class. And what you see, particularly by 1700, is that America that is being formed here in an identity, certainly not a country yet and not even a thought of rebellion, but in the emergence of this American identity, there is a land of the middle class. And this is the great distinguishing feature between colonial society and English society. A skilled worker skilled workers in England will make two to three times less than what farmers will make who occupy this middle class in the colonies. They have very few, if any, deeply subservient attitudes. They feel, and they do, that you could snub George Washington or Thomas Jefferson and go on about your way. You can have unlimited work at virtually unlimited wages if you're willing to do it. And for this, it gives most people a real sense of power and independence that they would never have had in England, a degree of economic independence. And over time, they demand to be heard. Now, at the very bottom of this social scale that we're discussing are the Piney Woods people, and they make up a much smaller percentage of the desperately poor than constitute the population in England, but it's still sizable, and I would argue that it's between 20 to 30% in some areas, between 20 and 30%. So overall, two big facts that you need to keep in mind. The colonies have a high standard of living, and by the time of the American Revolution, it is the highest standard of living in the entire world. It's definitely much higher than you have in England. So that's right, the colonies have a higher standard of living for the colonists than do the English in the mother country. Secondly, there's much greater economic mobility than in England. In England, if your dad is poor, you will be poor. If your father is wealthy, you likely will be wealthy. But that's not the case in the colonies. In the colonies, you have a chance to rise above the status or station of your parents, and even in many places, to climb into the upper ranks of society. In the South, by becoming a lawyer and a slaveholder. In the North, by becoming a merchant and having access to and by being prosperous. Now, I want us to switch gears here yet again and discuss two episodes of social unease, two periods of social tension. There are largely two ways to tell American history, and one of them is a consensus model, and the other is a conflict model. And over time, the historiography has swung back and forth between these two visions for the larger swath of American history and whether it should be seen as a history told as if conflict is at its center or whether consensus should be at its center. During the time of the early 20th century, as progressivism was the dominant movement in the United States and involved class conflict, labor unrest, urbanization, conflict and tension over trying to clean up cities, many historians writing at the time thought that the best way to understand American history was to see in it conflict. And so for them, battling in the early 20th century to clean up the crime, corruption, and filth of the cities, they looked back and saw in their forefathers at the time of the Civil War and the time of the Revolution that conflict was inherent in the American system. And so what they were doing was part and parcel of the American way. Decades, though, go by, and a different perspective comes to rule the day. And here now we talk about the 1930s, 40s, and the beginning of the Cold War in the 50s. And many historians, particularly writing in the 50s, called themselves consensus historians. And these consensus historians looked out at the world at large after American experiences during World War II, dealing with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, and then with the Cold War, with the Soviet Union, with communism. And for them, whatever differences existed in American history were in fact minor. They were shades of differences compared to the profound differences between the United States and these different types of political and economic systems that were abroad. And so historians writing in the 1950s, consensus historians told a story that was largely one that lacked the type of profound tension and conflict that these progressive historians had told. Well, things would shift yet again, and by the time of the 1960s, with the civil rights movement and conflict over Vietnam, historians again were seeing social conflict and tension inherent in American society, and so they again changed and wrote histories that were more rooted in conflict than consensus. So I ask you now to decide for yourself whether the model we have told so far is largely one of consensus or conflict, and if in fact that might be changing as we embark on stories about one episode of social unrest in the South, Bacon's Rebellion, it happens in Virginia, and then one that happens in the North, the Salem Witch Trials in Massachusetts. First, Bacon's Rebellion. The year 1676. Nathaniel Bacon has come over to Virginia, actually been sent there by his father, to try to make a fortune for his own. By this point, as a young man from a wealthy family in England, he has squandered a decent inheritance. And so he has been sent over with a letter of introduction to the governor, Governor Berkeley of Virginia, in the hopes that Bacon, Nathaniel Bacon, will make his way in the colonies and grow up and be a much better and more responsible young man. William Berkeley welcomes Bacon into his home. Berkeley is the governor of Virginia. Born and raised in England, Berkeley is like many of the men in the colonial government sent over to run the colony by the king. He is arrogant, he's haughty, and he believes that he is a better sort who has every right to prosper on the backs of the colonists, and he does so. He endures much longer than many others might have. Most of the colonial governors came over and anticipated a stay of only a few years, then they would move on to their next post. Not so with Berkeley. He settles in Virginia and finds it a comfortable place to be governor. And here in 1676, Berkeley is elderly, and he has been the governor off and on, and if even not the governor, the most prominent politician in Virginia colonial affairs since the 1640s. Now, by the time that Bacon arrives, there are a number of factors which have bred a degree of unease and uncertainty in Virginia, and we'll go over those in a moment. But what's immediately exposed to Bacon when he arrives is that even though he is invited to stay in Berkeley's house by Berkeley, he realizes that he's not being invited to join the Green Springs clique. Berkeley's plantation is called Green Springs, and he's gathered around him a group of advisors and cohorts, business partners, and other wealthy men, oftentimes with positions in government, who consistently benefit from the tax policy and knowledge that they gain of impending land transactions and other affairs going on in the colony. So even though Bacon is allowed and in fact invited to stay at Green Springs while his mansion is being built, he realizes he's not being invited to join the Green Springs clique, and he's offended by this. But if you look at it from Berkeley's perspective, it's not surprising. Berkeley is a much older man, having made his way in the world. He's been the governor here almost longer than Bacon has been alive, and he's doing nothing more than being gracious to Bacon's father in England to allow the son to stay with him. So there becomes a degree of jealousy and an undertone of animosity that creeps into the relationship between the young Bacon and the elderly Berkeley. Now, in addition to Berkeley's attitude toward Bacon, there are a number of other issues brewing at the time that are breeding public discontent. Let me go through these for you. Number one, a depression in the tobacco market. Tobacco growers were being hurt by a glut. And unfortunately, the laws in England at the time, called the Navigation Acts, that governed the English economic system, allowed the colonists no option but to sell their tobacco in the English markets. So in good years, this was a decided benefit because you had a market for your goods. But in years in which there was too much, you couldn't go expand and find markets elsewhere to try to expand the marketplace and bolster price. So the tobacco market is depressed. Secondly, a heavy tax burden. Berkeley has raised taxes primarily for two purposes during the course of his governorship, and both of them related to warfare. His governorship has straddled these decades in which the British and the Dutch have fought a number of wars, and during one of those wars, a Dutch flotilla of warships sailed into Jamestown Harbor and literally carried off wholesale the tobacco crop for 1 year. So the British tobacco market here is under threat. So Berkeley raised the taxes and built a fort in the harbor to protect ships inside of it. And even after the British have conclusively defeated the Dutch and gained the upper hand, the fort still requires money to be spent every year to keep it up. The second part of his policy is policy out in the West involving Indians and settlers. A slow but steady series of attacks and low-grade warfare occurs on the frontier. And Berkeley, in an effort to try to bring some solution to this problem on the frontier, spends tax money to build a series of forts on the West. And the idea here is that by building these forts, he can house troops there to protect the settlers. In fact, the fortifications are totally ineffective. What happens is that when the Indians go on the warpath, they simply run by the forts, and the soldiers see no reason to sally forth out of them and possibly risk their lives, so they actually watch from the forts as the Indians attack the settlers and burn their villages and kill them. So this policy looks ineffective. Rather than having some type of mobile defense to defend the frontier, his policy of these fortifications looks quite poor. And number three is, despite the is really woven in with the second one that I gave you here, you've got the number two being the expenses associated with the forts on the frontier, and then the fort that's in Jamestown Harbor. Maybe those would have been bearable if they had been effective. But the problem here is the money's been expended and will continue to be, and the policies aren't effective either in the West or with the fort. The fact is that the British victory largely clears Dutch ships out of the Atlantic, so there really isn't a need for the fort, but yet it remains as a sign of a reminder of Dutch ships that had once been in the harbor. And number four, corrupt handling by the Crown of Western lands. Now, Berkeley signed off on it and received what on the surface of it appears to be a request, but a request that he believes he can't turn down. And that's a request from the king to make a large grant of western lands in Virginia to some of his favorites. Why does he do this? To try to gain the favor of these men at court that he would like to need support from for some reason. The problem is it alienates Berkeley from the settlers, who now won't have access to the western land. So income down, resentments up, taxes are up, and there's no access to more land. So it's in this environment that Bacon has arrived. After being, as I told you, warmly greeted by Berkeley and invited to remain at the Green Springs clique, he remains there seething and boiling to some extent until his mansion is finished. And then he begins to hold a series of gatherings there among other planters and wealthy men who aren't part of the Green Springs clique and feel disillusioned and disenchanted with Berkeley. And over time, these forces gathering at Bacon's plantation will coalesce into an anti-Berkeley force under Bacon. Berkeley doesn't see it, but in fact, Bacon, with the clarity of the uncluttered mind, appreciates the challenges here for Virginia society and how Berkeley can be made to blame for many of them. And Bacon is charismatic and he is persuasive. Berkeley, though, is overconfident, and he has been governing the colony a long time, and he doesn't appreciate the challenge and the threat that's here in front of him. He begins to take steps to try to appease some of the public discontent, but unfortunately, before he can get very far with it, events far to the north begin to shape the outcome of events in ways that he could never have anticipated. The Iroquois far to the north in New York become much more aggressive and declare war against a number of tribes to the south. And so what happens is a kind of domino effect that pushes tribes, each in turn south, finally into Virginia in this kind of domino effect. And the result, war on the frontier. Immediately as war breaks out on the frontier, Bacon demands reprisals. Now, Berkeley here might have the better policy. He urges caution, noting that the war would add to Virginia's tax burden. But at this point, people are not willing to listen to Berkeley in a policy of moderation. Bacon realizes that there's an opening here, gathers a force of 1,000 men, and he began a campaign against some local Indians. And what this turns into is the discovery that he's also a very capable military leader, and he goes to war and wins victories on the frontier, endearing the settlers to him. Berkeley misjudges the situation and fails to appreciate the threat that has now matured and metastasized in his presence. He calls Bacon the greatest rebel that ever was in Virginia. And even worse, he calls the men serving with Bacon mutineers. This only serves to separate Berkeley even further.